The Vintage Gamer, Episode 18, Pente.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. This week, The Vintage Gamer is brought to you by Dimming J. Slanderous, junk email producer extraordinaire. Need your box filled with spam? Call Dimming. He'll be glad to help. And as always, this show is available via RSS or direct download at www.thevintagegamer.net. Well, I'm going to take two on this show. The first one got recorded through the internal microphone of the laptop, which didn't sound so terribly good. So I'm going at it again. The big news this week is Dragon Con. I'm going with Murr, and we'll be participating in the podcasting panels, and I may be participating in a gaming panel. I know Murr is in a gaming panel. The podcasting panels will be up on the fourth floor of the Hilton Hotel in the board director room. The main panel that I'm participating in is the Podcasting for Games, and that's going to be this Friday at 7 p.m. We're going to have myself, of course, Bobby Blackwolf of the Bobby Blackwolf Show, Sam Chupp of the Bears Grove, Dom Dem of Pulp Gamer, the Mad 3 of Gamer the Podcasting. So looks like a good mix of coverage. We've got computer games, we've got RPGs, board games, and LARPing covered there. So please, if you are at Dragon Con, do show up. I have brand new shiny buttons to give away, so show up and I'll give you a button. And right after that, in the same room, I and a group of people will be doing the radio play Lance Biggs, Spaceman. And that's going to be at 8:30 in that same room, as I said. That show features Steve Ely of Escape Pod as Lancelot Biggs, Rich Siegfried of Mr. Adventure as Cap Hansen, Jason Adams of Random Signal as Navigator Dick Todd, Murr Lafferty of way too many podcast name here. All right, Geek Fu Action Grip as Diane Hansen, and T. Morris of the Survival Guide to Writing as Ship's Engineer McDougal. Oh, and I'm playing the Communications Officer Sparks. If you're not going to be at Dragon Con, you can actually hear a version of this podcast or of this radio play on the Balticon podcast feed. But if you are going to be there, it should be a blast. Other than that, as I said, I might be participating in some other panels, but I'm not entirely sure. Those are the ones that I'm signed up for. In other news, I wanted to point people to a new podcast out there called The Abstract Gamer, which is covering abstract games, of all things. I listened to the second one, which was actually a re-recording of the first one, about Chushogi and just plain shogi itself. And there's a new one up this week about handicaps and GIF. I really enjoyed the first one, and I would say give it a listen. I am going to be trying to talk a little bit more about abstract games in this podcast, but I think that one also provides a good counterpoint. Finally, on my blog, I mentioned this, but I got a chance to play the Dunwich Horror expansion to Arkham Horror, and it's a lot of fun. So if you like Arkham Horror, I definitely recommend trying to pick this up when it comes out. The date that I saw was September 30th. It was out for Gen Con. Well, they actually specially got, I think, 100 copies for Gen Con. So there's a possibility it'll be out a little sooner than that. But September is the date. And that's about it for news. I'll be back right after this.
Firepoint Media, in conjunction with Dragon Con, America's largest multimedia popular arts convention, presents Podcasting Now and Beyond, a celebration of portable media programming bringing together the full spectrum of podcasters and their audience, from pros to first-timers, for a conference of information and entertainment. Join us for panels, seminars, workshops, and events culminating in the Parsec Awards, honoring podcasting excellence and speculative fiction. Visit our website at www.parsecawards.com to join us in podcasting history. Podcasting now and beyond, September 1st through 4th at the DragonCon Convention in Atlanta, Georgia. Your future to the power of beyond.
And now to Pente. Pente is a two-player abstract which was originally published in 1977 by Pente Incorporated. And it came in two forms, which is a roll-up travel version in a tube, which I have, and a larger one that featured a hard board. It was designed by Gary Gabrell and was heavily based on a Japanese game called Renju. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. Pente is actually a part of a large class of games played with the pieces from Go, where the goal, not the goal of Go, but the goal of this class of games, is to get five stones in a row. So, rather than leap into Pente directly, I'm going to give a brief overview of some of these games and show the evolution into Pente, as it were. For those not familiar with Go, it is an ancient Chinese game. Well, in Chinese it's called Wei Qi. The Japanese name is Go, played on a grid of 19 horizontal and 19 vertical lines. You can think of a checkerboard, but with the active playing area being the corners or intersections of the spaces rather than the centers. On these corners, the two players alternate placing black and white stones and try to surround their opponent and take territory or their opponent's stones. That kind of gives you a general taste of Go. I'm not going to do any more detail on that, but I might do a show on it later. Now, from these pieces was derived a much simpler game, which dates back to at least 700 AD, and possibly back to 100 AD. And it has many names, the most common being Go Moku, meaning 5 points, or Go Ban, meaning 5 board. And commonly, Go Ban is corrupted as Go Bang. And again, we have a black and white player which alternate placing stones. But the goal is now, as I indicated, to get exactly 5 stones in a row, horizontally, vertically, or diagonally. Now, note I said exactly, 6 or more stones do not count. In this basic game, the first player, black, has a huge advantage, and it is assumed can always win with correct play. To fix this, starting in the late 1800s in Japan, additional rules were added to kind of hamstring black's advantage. And these have been codified as Renju, or Row of Pearls. In essence, there are certain formations that black can simply not play, or he loses the game. For example, black cannot place a single stone and create, at one time, 2 separate rows of 3. Now, this being a non-visual medium, it may be kind of hard to think about it, but all right, imagine a row of 2 black stones, and next to it, a column of 2 more black stones, forming an L with the corner cut out. Now, if black places a stone in the corner, he would form 2 groups of 3 in a row with 1 move. Another example is that black cannot form an overline, which is a row of 6 or more stones. There are other examples, which we're not going to get into now, but that gives you the general idea. Now, note that these restrictions only apply to black. None of them apply to white, so white can pretty much do whatever he or she wants. Now, that's just the general game. There are also additional restrictions in the opening. Black will play the first piece in the center, which I forgot to mention is true of Go Moku as well, and then makes the move for white. And this has to be horizontally or vertically connected to the center piece. And then he makes a move within a small central square for black. At this point, white can decide whether to continue as white, or may switch sides and play the black pieces instead. whatever decision is made, whoever plays white does the next move, and then black offers white a choice of two moves that black will make. White will pick one, black will play it, and then play finally continues without any further restrictions, other than the previous ones I mentioned for black. Now, as you can tell, there's a fair amount to remember there. As if that wasn't enough, later on to this was added one additional rule. Now, suppose your opponent has two pieces in a line, just a pair of pieces in a row. If you surround those two pieces with two pieces of your own color, along the same line, diagonal, horizontal, vertical, then you may take the two central pieces. And with this game, you can win in two ways. You can either get five in a row, or you can take 10 of your opponent's pieces. At least one reference calls this version Korean Gomoku, which I think kind of hints at its origin, but generally it's called Ninuki Renju. Which finally brings us to Mente. Take all of the complex rules that correct black's advantage in Renju and just throw them out. But keep the capturing rules of Ninuki Renju. Oh, and just as a further variant, you can get six or more in a row and still win the game. So basically, it's a much simplified version of Ninuki Renju. And also, there are some other changes made, I guess, to make it more accessible to Western audiences. So, for example, white goes first instead of black, so it matches chess. Again, more familiar to the Western audiences. There are also some new terminologies which are introduced to fit the Greek retheming of the game. First of all, there's the tria, which is from the Greek word for three, and that is three in a row with no opposing stones on either side. I often just call this an open three. Similarly, a tessera is four in a row, again, with no opposing stones on either side. And a pente is just simply five in a row. Opposing stones are no. Also, similar to calling check in chess, you need to warn your opponents if you create a tria or a tessera. And, of course, pente is equivalent to checkmate. Are we done? Is that pretty much it for pente? Well, let's see. We've got a 19x19 board. We've got black and white stones. Five in a row, five captures wins. So, is that it? Well, kind of. The problem is that we've removed the rules that prevent the starting player from having an overwhelming advantage. And so, guess what? The starting player has an overwhelming advantage again. To counteract this, a whole new set of rules were proposed for tournaments, known as tournament or pro pente. As before, white opens in the center. Black can play anywhere. Then white must play at least 3 points away from the center, and after that, play continues normally. Now, given the complexity of all those rules in Renju, it's hard to believe that that simple opening gambit completely balances out pente. And because of this, another change was proposed in 1983 by Raleigh Tesh, the current pente world champion at that time. Instead of changing the opening, he suggested that capturing of three stones in a row should be allowed instead. This prevents players from placing two in a row and then just extending them to three in a row to avoid capture when threatened. So now the new winning conditions are five in a row or 15 stones captured, and this version is called Karyo Pente. Now, this apparently was not enough for some people, and there's also D-Pente, which was suggested by Don Banks. This is the same as standard Pente, but with opening rules reminiscent of Renju. So player 1 gets to place the first white stone in the center, and then player 1 places the first black stone anywhere they like, and then he gets to place a white stone. Note that there are no move restrictions on those second or third moves, unlike Renju. And at this point, the second player gets to choose what color they want to play. Play continues normally with whomever is black. So that's a quick overview of all of the major five in a row games. Is your head full yet? Well, maybe we should take a little break, sip a little sake, and listen to this. I'll be right back.
Follow the Path, the Bear's Grove podcast. Adult-level discussion of role-playing as a storytelling art at bearsgrove.com.
As mentioned, Pentai was originally self-published, or at least copyrighted, in 1977 by Gary Gabrel. Interest in Pentai was strong enough that tournaments began in the following year, up until 1983, when Parker Brothers bought out the brand and didn't sponsor any more tournaments. There was one last 20th anniversary tournament in 1998, which was sponsored by Hasbro. The dominant players of the early 80s were John Krenz, Tom Bronlich, and Raleigh Tesh, who we've already met. Tom Bronlich went on to write a couple of books on Pentai strategy, which are out of print, but I do recommend and can be found on the internet for reasonable prices. Now, once Parker Brothers was bought out by Hasbro, the brand truly began to suffer and wasn't published for a while. It did come back in 1988 with a 20th anniversary edition published by Decipher, of all places, and is now published by Winning Moves in both the hardboard and roll-up versions, similar very much to the original ones in the 1980s. The latest version has a new variant called Pentai Plus that adds 4 additional wild card stones in a third color. It also includes rules for a 4-player partnership version, which I think is the one that Tom Bronlich came up with. It's published in the back of his first strategy book. And speaking of multiplayer versions, in the back of that book there's another version which you can play non-partnership, basically a free-for-all amongst many players. A friend of mine, I was telling him about this show, and he mentioned he used to play this back in the 80s. It works pretty much the same as regular Pentai, except when capturing, all you need to do is surround 2 stones of colors other than your own. And it goes pretty fast, he says. My personal history with Pentai began back in the early 80s when I got a copy, that 2 version again, for my birthday or Christmas. I played a little bit with a friend of mine in college, even to the point of tracking down one of the strategy books by Bronlich, that one I mentioned again, just so I could do a little bit better. And he and I actually talked about writing an AI for it at some point, but I got distracted by writing chess and reverse AIs. Actually, there was the contest that we had, some of the people in the computer science department, where we tried to write reverse AIs and challenge each other. That was a lot of fun, but the Pentai idea never really panned out. After college, I kind of dropped playing Pentai at all. Actually, after college, I didn't play many games at all. Went to grad school. But it sat in my closet for years until a few months ago at work, I saw somebody playing what looked like Go on a webpage. And I realized that it was Pentai. And I got that old gleam in my eye again. And dug out the game board and the strategy guide and started it up. Now, I can't say that I'm really any good at it. I mean, I had to buy the strategy guide after all. But I am having fun with it. I think the thing that I like about it is that Go to me is a little too abstract. I'm never quite sure what I'm supposed to do. You know, I've looked at some Go games and I go, why did you put that stone there? I'm sure that he's got some long-term blocking move plan, but I'm not really sure what he has in mind. And chess to me feels like a whole bunch of memorization at this point, trying to learn opening books and various strategies and things like that. Pentai seems to be about the right level for me. And especially with the non-real-time interface, the web interface, it makes for a good break at work. And all I have to do is log in, check the latest moves by my opponents, make a few of my own, and then I'm back to work. Now, despite my relative lack of experience, I've played, I think, 13 games online now. I have come up with some tips if you're a beginning player. Now, first of all, pairs, 2 in a row, are very weak. If your opponent can surround and capture them, then he can destroy your defensive or offensive structures very easily, which can cause you a great deal of problems. So if you have a pair and everything is hanging off that pair, he captures the pair, and then he can suddenly start breaking down the rest of your structures. what you want to do is create what's called a potential, which is a stone, then a space, and then another stone. And this is a much stronger structure because then if you place a stone in the center, it becomes a tria. And trias are very strong, unless, of course, you're playing the Cario variant. Of course, if your opponent is doing this, you can try to place a stone in the middle to stop them, unless you have other plans. Now, trias are extremely dangerous because they can lead to a tessera, which is an automatic win. So if someone has three in a row with no block on either side, you just put another one down at the end. Now you have four in a row with no opposing stones on either side. And no matter which side you place a blocking stone on, your opponent can put one on the other side and get five. So if you see a tria, you either have to capture one of the stones and make it up, or block it on one side or the other, or give your opponent something else to think about, like a tessera, for example. Now, from this, you can try to build more complex structures. And this is where my strategy starts to fall down. I'm pretty good at the tactics. If I see an opportunity, I can take advantage of it, but I can't seem to create opportunities for myself yet. But basically, you want to set up a situation where placing a single stone causes your opponent to choose between the lesser of two evils. So, for example, you could force them to place a stone which would create an easily captured pair. But if they don't, then you can build an open tessera and win the game. If you do something like that enough times, then you can win through captures. Another trick is to realize that, at least for beginners, that it's hard to see some winning structures. So, for example, if you have a pair of stones on a diagonal, then a gap, and then a single stone on that same diagonal, and you mix that in with a large collection of other stones, your opponent might not notice that you can place a single stone and build a tessera. One thing I've noticed is that there's a certain ebb and flow to the game. One player will have the initiative for a while and be building structures across the board, and the other one will just be responding and blocking and capturing and just trying to stop them from winning. And then the first player will just kind of run out of things to do. They'll just build a structure so far, and then it kind of peters out. And then it'll be the second player's turn to try to build their structures. And obviously, your intent is to maintain this initiative as long as possible. If you can maintain that initiative, eventually you end up with a situation where you can place a stone that will give you the win. Now, if you're interested in more details on Pente strategy, I do, again, suggest looking up Bronlich's books, which have been published in a single volume, but you can also buy them separately. I think they're called Pente Strategy A and B. There's also a number of good websites out there with tips and tricks, which I'll link to in the show notes. And many of the strategies and tactics used in Renju are useful as well, because it uses a lot of the same structures. Now, obviously, there's a little more freedom with structures in Pente than Renju, but still, it's good to look at those as a reference. As I think I indicated, if you want to play Pente, there are a number of websites out there where you can take on human beings. I'm on Pente.net, and that's mainly because that's where my coworkers started out. And if you want to challenge me there, I am Cthulhim, and that's C-T-H-U-L-H-I-M, or Cthulhu with an I-M at the end. There's also Pente.org, which I think provides a few more game options if you're looking for that. And I suspect there are many other places as well. Now, if you don't want to play humans and you just want to go up against an AI, Mark Mammal has provided a pretty decent freeware program for Windows that certainly does a good job of kicking my butt. The link, of course, will be in the show notes. I myself would rather play humans because humans occasionally screw up. Now, hopefully, all of this has drawn your interest in Pente. I think picking up a set is well worth your money only because of the large variety of games you can play with it. Now, of course, for a further investment, you can get a decent Go set and play many, many more games. But that is a show for another time. I'll be back with Empire Builder feedback right after this.
Thanks for breaking the ice, but I am a gamer. Owning some electronic mind zapper doesn't make you a gamer, so don't take this name from me. I play with pulp, dice, paper, plastic, something you can touch, feel, smell. I am a gamer. Thanks to this mass media insurgence, I must swim into a diluted sea of gaming nomenclature just to make my point. Play games with depth, play games with pulp. My gamer t-shirt doesn't have anything to do with your video-addicted brother-in-law. Thanks for breaking the ice, but I am a gamer. PulpGamer.com.
The Empire Builder episode produced a lot of feedback. Most of it positive. A lot of you really liked the addition of Murr to the show, while there were a couple, I won't name names, who weren't so sure. One of them, in fact, was disappointed that I was bringing on guests at all. Well, all right, look, let me just try to cut through to the middle. I'm not planning on changing the show to the Jim and Murr show. I hate to disappoint the people who really liked her presence, but I'm really only going to bring her on if she's familiar and gung-ho about the game that I'm talking about that week. Now, don't get me wrong, while we did have a lot of fun, I just don't want to jeopardize the character of the show. There is one other show I might do with her that I can think of, so I'm pretty sure she'll be back. Sorry, detractors. But not often. Now, to the naysayers, as I said last week, I will be bringing on more guests. But my goal is to hopefully accent the Lone Gunman shows, but not to replace them. What you're hearing right now is still going to be the core of the show. But, for example, I really want to do a show on Titan. And this is a reasonably long and complex game that I have never played. Now, trying to play it enough times to do a decent show on it would be tough, but I have a friend who loves this game and has played it many times. So I can bring him on and use him as my resident expert, as it were. In the end, don't worry about it. I'm not going to change the show too much. All I want to do is add a little bit to it. And all I want to try to keep that energy I get from another person and bring it into the solo shows. And kind of kick it up a notch, if you will. We'll see if that works. Now, as to the content of the Empire Builder show, there were some good comments and questions. Matthew left a comment on the website that had a few questions on it. I just want to point out one of them, which is, how do the crayons work? Do you just wipe them off when done, or do they damage the board? Well, that's a good point. I forgot to talk about that. The crayons, I'm going to quote from a comment from Steve, who I believe is a big rail gamer. He says, the crayons included with the game are softer than the common Crayolas, and they wipe off the smooth map with a paper towel. Very succinctly put. I'll just add to that that you can use China markers or grease pencils on the boards as well. Or some people like to cover them with a transparent piece of plastic and use dry erase or transparency pens. And usually when they do that, they set the game in a frame and then put the plastic on top. Otherwise, the plastic will slide around, and you'll lose where the track is supposed to go on the actual dots. Now, Robert had a comment about pigs in North Carolina, which I'll quote here. Now, I realize the following correction is going to sound really geeky, and I apologize for nitpicking, but Murr had a small gripe about pigs not being available for pickup in North Carolina, despite how large the hog industry is in North Carolina. She's right that North Carolina has a lot of pigs. It's currently the second largest producer in the U.S. However, when Empire Builder was published, North Carolina was not as big into pigs. And then he goes into gazetteer figures to prove his point. And all right, you are correct, sir. But, in defense of Murr, and how can I do otherwise, I will point out that the game has been revised since then, so they could have updated it to reflect the current distribution of commodities. Besides, pigs are more fun than tobacco. But you are right, in all seriousness. Finally, both Brian Turner and Grognads on BoardGameGeek wrote about the original tokens that were used with Empire Builder were little metal locomotives. In the original one, they were all models of a diesel-electric locomotive, painted different colors. But in later editions, Mayfair just has a little plastic pawn. Looks kind of like a cylinder with a peak on top. What Mayfair did is that they actually sold an extra set of four locomotive miniatures to be used with the game. Brian writes that they are the Union Pacific Big Boy, a Norfolk and Western J, a Mogul, and an EMD GP35 diesel-electric, which he thinks is what was used in the original version. He says here, the trouble with the pawns is their size. You have to put them on the track sideways because they can cover several points. They are all over 1 inch long, except for the Big Boy, but that is actually over 1.5 inches long. Well, thank you, both Grognaz and Brian. I have considered picking up those pawns for the look, but I had concerns about putting them on the board, and based on your comments, I think I'm going to stick with the standard plastic pawns. I guess I'm more into the practicality of playing the game versus the nifty look. I don't know, maybe I'll pick them up just for the nicety of having four neat pewter miniatures of trains. Okay, and that's just a few of the many comments that this show produced. I want to thank everybody who sent them in. It's all greatly appreciated. If you have feedback for the Vintage Gamer on the show or any other, you can leave comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net, or you can contact me directly via email at vintagejim@gmail.com, which is where I got a few of these comments, or you can talk to me via Skype, where I am known as JV Square, and I will try to remember to keep Skype up and running so you can actually do that. Unfortunately, my voicemail number is gone since I never got any calls. Boo-hoo. I'll try to get another number at some point, but however the means, feedback is always welcome. And thus concludes yet another black and white episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The next episode of The Vintage Gamer will most likely be a DragonCon episode of some kind. Maybe the podcast panel, maybe just comments on DragonCon. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.